Big tech has ruined the internet. AI is everywhere, and Elon Musk is in the White House. We may have high tech, so why does it seem like our quality of life is only getting lower?
This is System Crash, a weekly tech news show willing to tell the hard truths about how tech and the titans who own and operate it is really transforming the world. I'm Paris. I'll be one of your co-hosts. You might know me from Tech Won't Save Us or from the writing that I do in Disconnect or anywhere else. Or maybe you even read my book, Road to Nowhere.
Yeah, it's a good one. I'm Brian Merchant. I am a longtime tech writer as well. You may have heard me on a number of Paris's podcast episodes over at Tech Won't Save Us. I used to be the tech columnist at the LA Times. I was a senior editor at the late great Motherboard, RIP. And I have written some books, most recently Blood in the Machine, which is about the Luddite uprising and what the Luddites can teach us about AI and automation today. And you're going to have to forgive me for my clumsy radio guy voice. I'm still working it out. I've got a few different registers. I think I can work in here. I don't have like the polished like drive time.
Give him a few episodes and he'll have like a proper podcaster voice ready to go. You know, obviously everyone needs to pick up Ryan's book because it's fantastic. Blood in the Machine, you know, his other one is good too. But Brian, you know, on your voice, how does it feel to be a podcaster now?
I'm officially a podcaster. You know, as an elder millennial, I was doing some soul searching and I went to the beach at sunset and I was kind of like thinking about my life. You know, I was laid off from the Times during a period of mass layoffs along with 100 plus other colleagues, and I was reflecting and I just, you know, I'm approaching middle age now as a millennial, and I realized as like a white guy in media, the one thing that I just never had was my very own podcast. So this was it needed to be done. I'm not allowed to like depart from this earth until I do a podcast. So it's been quite a journey for me. I think I told you when I was doing it that I went to Best Buy to get a mic. It was the closest place to get one. And just like, there's like literally the podcasting kit. You get like the Shure mic. If you want to get a nice microphone at Best Buy, like it was either this or like kind of a cheaper, crappier one. So like I was just desperately looking through the back of the shelf so I didn't like have to go to the checkout with something called a podcasting kit.
They were judging you so hard there.
the cashier, like, I think they're like, they must have some kind of prompt that whenever anyone buys one, they're like legally obligated to ask you if you're starting a podcast.
It pops up on the screen. Have you asked if this person is starting a podcast?
I am starting a podcast. I'm sorry. But this podcast is going to be great.
It's going to be a good podcast.
Yeah. It's a good podcast. It's not like all those other extraneous podcasts out there that are polluting the feeds. Now, this is the one podcast.
It's an uplifting podcast that is about to brighten everyone's day with the joy that comes with discussing the tech industry these days, right?
Yeah, it is. It's just I'm going to put some pep in everyone's step. We wouldn't be doing it, I think, if we didn't feel like this was actually an important and relevant and necessary kind of thing to do. You know, we've been, I don't know, a year now? Maybe we first floated it even earlier at some point after the second or third or fourth time I was on the show. So it's always been kind of in the air, right? Like we've texted about it, and you know, it wasn't like the election happened and then we just decided to like to pull the trigger on this. It's been in the works for a couple months, but it certainly, I feel like, has just underscored the I think the necessity. Who knows? Maybe it's a little pompous to say it's like necessary to listen to a podcast. Yeah, it's certainly not, but it's going to make me feel better to rant about everything that's going on in Silicon Valley.
I thought podcasts were the most important thing in the world. I thought they were shaping elections these days. Like the podcasters are everything.
That's right. Yeah, that's how we're justifying it. We need to become the liberal left Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
So support us in our endeavor so we can do that.
Everyone's competing for the title these days, right? So we need to throw our our names into the ring. Yeah.
It's high time. It's high time we threw our name in the ring. You know, I can shave my head.
But you'll lose all that luscious long hair. Like, we can't have that happen.
Hey, look, man, yeah, that's true. I'll put it in a ponytail. How about that?
There we go. You need to go through a bout of hosting Fear Factor first.
That's true. I got to eat some bugs. And then we'll...
But listen, we have been talking about the show for a while. We have been watching the system crash in real time and, you know, just deciding when to start this thing. And then I think it really says something about what is happening out in the world that as we're preparing for this podcast to come into existence, you know, we have the election of a Donald Trump presidency with this massive backing of the tech industry and these like right-wing billionaires in the tech industry. It really just plays into exactly what we are trying to talk about and what we are trying to dig into with this very show.
Yeah, I mean, it really just crystallizes all of the elements, I think, just about that we've been critical of over the last few years, whether it's like the deregulation of the tech industry. You know, we have Elon Musk gunning for the NLRB. We have crypto going nuts. It's going to be high times for crypto as Bitcoin booms. We got a cadre of right-wing Silicon Valley titans now in a place of sort of the highest rungs of power, Elon Musk and his network, Peter Thiel, and their defense tech companies. There's just going to be an open channel. These guys are talking about gutting the government. We'll talk about that in a second, while certainly sort of greasing, you know, the wheels for an even sort of larger Silicon Valley defense industry, you know, apparatus and tech monopoly apparatus. So these are three very large figures. And on top of all of that, we now have this regime that will deregulate everything, including AI, at a moment when the bubble is kind of poised, you know, many are saying perhaps to burst with so much, you know, hyper investment and interest in AI and a lot of questions around that. And Trump's new EPA pick is saying we got to do all we can for AI. He's the EPA administrator. It's a dream for guys like Mark Andreessen and Elon Musk, guys on the tech right. In many ways, this is going to be a right-wing tech titan presidency with Elon Musk pushing all these buttons that, you know, and it's a direct line to Donald Trump all the time.
Well, that's it, right? Like, there's so many different aspects of this that we can talk about. But one of the things that really stands out to me when we discuss this is last time Donald Trump came to power, yes, he had the backing of Peter Thiel. You know, Peter Thiel was behind him. He spoke at the Republican National Convention, but you didn't have a lot more of these tech folks like coming out and vocally supporting him. And one of the things that Thiel said afterward was that he kind of soured on Trump because Trump wasn't willing to go hard enough on, you know, what they would call like the deep state and putting like total whack jobs in positions of power and stuff, because Trump was like somewhat reined in by the Republican Party, the like established norms, all this kind of stuff that existed before. But you can clearly see, as we've been seeing these cabinet picks kind of flowing out over the past week or so, that is gone, right? Exactly the type of thing that a Peter Thiel wanted to see Donald Trump do by totally like throwing the government into disarray, putting complete whack jobs in positions of power, is exactly what they are getting now. And not to mention that you have these people in Silicon Valley, you have these tech billionaires who are poised to really shape policy, not just how the levers of government are going to work, but to make sure that their industry is going to benefit immensely from it and can do basically what they want over the next 4 years, not just, you know, in their own like little spheres, but to make sure that how the government works in the future, how the United States relates to the world is going to be one that benefits them. This like very cloistered, very limited in how they view the world kind of people who are so disconnected from the average person, are going to be shaping so much of what we all experience. And there's no question, based on the things that you were saying, what we've already seen from the tech industry, it's so obvious that that is going to be so harmful for so many people.
You know, it's going to be a rough period. It's going to be a dark period. I think everybody understands that. I think just there are some similarities and dissimilarities between the onset of the Trump administration between now and last time he took power. I think you're exactly right. He no longer feels restrained by sort of a need to sort of appeal to decorum or to, you know, include some establishment picks. And we're getting just some like truly unhinged cabinet appointments like Matt Gaetz, for for Attorney General.
I love that every time like the media reports on that, they use the picture of Matt Gaetz when he's like totally Botoxed up at the Republican National Convention or wherever it was. I'm like, at least they're doing that to him, you know?
Yeah. He just, I mean, I don't think there is like a picture available of him in which he does not look like the sex pest sleazeball that he is.
Yeah.
But this is a guy, again, like Elon has endorsed him too. This is a triumvirate of guys who have sexual allegations against them and who just are saying like, we don't care, right? We don't give a shit. We're just going to, you know, appoint these guys, whether you like it or not. Gaetz may or may not turn out to be a bridge too far and may not get appointed by the Senate. But the point stands is that like sort of the thrust here to sort of enact this totally sort of transactional politics that Trump has always practiced. His first term was filled with transactional politics, and now it's only going to be even more nakedly so, because I think he feels like a lot of those barriers put up by the establishment, that there used to be factions that would at least grumble about Trump in the Republican Party. And in the interim, you know, 4 years since he was out of power, most of those folks have now been either sort of shed from the system, ushered out, or sort of been bent to his will. So there's less opposition on every level. And now this sort of transactional politics is going to extend not just within sort of like the circle of political figures and Trump's old business cronies and his lawyer who he wants to appoint as deputy attorney general, you know, conflict of interest be damned. It's going to extend via Elon Musk's, insofar as this relationship lasts, to a lot of these Silicon Valley figures who are now, again, closer than ever to power. So we're already seeing this transactional nature of politics sort of manifesting itself. We saw it on day one when all of the Silicon Valley CEOs immediately started pledging loyalty within hours. You know, Sam Altman, Sundar Pichai at Google, yeah, Bezos, even Tim Cook. They all congratulated him, all gave him phone calls, are all looking forward to work together. Mark Zuckerberg, maybe more than anyone besides Musk. And I think this part is transformative in a way that we're just beginning to see, because they all know how Trump does business. They saw it last time. They all know that it's a transactional game, that if you say nice things about him, you sort of kiss the ring, then he's much more likely not to sic the FTC on you. He's not ideological, even in the way that like J.D. Vance sort of professes to be, where he's saying things like, you know, he would keep Lina Khan at the FTC because he likes how she's breaking up the tech giant's power. Like, Trump doesn't care about that. Trump, I think, would only use such agencies as a tool to punish those he views as enemies. So that's why you had things like Jeff Bezos pulling his endorsement from the Washington Post or stopping it from running. And that looks like now, from a businessman's perspective, that looks like the smart move now. Now he's going to be in better graces with Trump. And this is the state of play. I don't think the tech monopolies are going to be challenged in any serious way, again, unless they run afoul of Trump somehow. There's a lot of chatter about Elon Musk and whether or not his relationship with Trump can hold. There are some like, you know, comments that we've seen where Trump's like, oh, Elon's always here, we can't get rid of him or something, that are funny. He's joking, but it's also like, are they kind of getting annoyed with him already?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm certainly of two minds about it, but more than anything, I feel like this is people who really want it to fall apart, who are like, this is going to happen, right? When is it going to happen? We need this to happen so that like this worst case scenario that we're seeing of this alliance between Trump and Musk does not continue for the next 4 years, right? And there's this hopefulness, like the little bit of hope that you can find in this dark time is like, obviously these two narcissists can't work together for any period of time and they're going to hate each other. But I tend to think that is probably not going to be the case, because even though, yes, they are total narcissists, even though Trump is probably going to get annoyed with the fact that Musk is kind of stealing some of his spotlight and things like that, I tend to believe that they both have enough interest in this staying together that they will make sure it does, right? Because on Trump's side, he has the richest man in the world on his side who has contributed a lot of money to make sure he gets elected. And from what we've seen, it seems that America PAC is planning to keep collecting voter information and planning to keep, you know, kind of funding races and things like that. Like, it's not just going away because Trump is elected now. It seems like this is going to be kind of an institution to help Republicans maintain power into the future as well. And so you don't want to totally give that up.
America PAC being Elon's super PAC.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then there's the other piece of this where Trump, in having this relationship to Musk, gets, like, you know, the kind of influence. And, you know, Elon has this cult around him, right? And so he gets to associate himself with this cult, but also this idea of, like, this is the future that the tech industry is building. Like, he gets wrapped up in this whole project, which is a project that we would be against and think is, like, quite bad. But for someone like Trump and this right-wing movement that is, like, glomming on to Elon Musk, it's a positive thing, right? And then on Elon's side, it's like, okay, his companies are facing all these investigations. By being close to Trump and the government, a lot of that will go away. He'll make sure he's not heavily taxed. He'll make sure that the government is giving his companies very favorable treatment. You know, the subsidies to SpaceX are going to keep flowing. And, you know, NASA and the U.S. space industry is just going to become even more dependent on SpaceX. So after 4 years, like, trying to unwind that is basically going to be impossible. Listen, I would love for this to all fall apart. I would love for these people to get in this big, like, row and this big public
fight. Nothing would be funnier.
Exactly. But I just think that the interests are aligned in such a way that it is not going to happen.
Yeah, that's my fear too. I think that more than, you know, can they work together? I think that's the wrong question. It's like, can they work, like, over each other? Like, can Trump, you know, sort of just tolerate Elon's omnipresence, right?
Yeah, Elon maybe needs to move out of Mar-a-Lago, but, like, still keep in contact, right?
And, like, and that's the thing, is he will. Like, I think he's going to get bored. Like, some of these bureaucratic projects are just not going to be satisfying in a way to him that launching a rocket and, you know, is going to be. And he can't, like, really tweet about, oh, you know, I mean, he's saying he's going to. In fact, we should probably start digging into that a little bit, because just today, as we're speaking, Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy ran against Trump in the primary, almost kind of as a joke. No one ever really took him seriously. And, you know, of course, then pledged fealty. And,
well, I think the All In podcast guys took him seriously for a while.
I guess to some people, that's all that matters. Yeah. But yeah, to those who aren't aware, they were put in charge of the DOGE department, the Department of Government Efficiency.
I was hearing Department of Government Efficiency, and, like, for a few weeks, I had not made the connection that it was DOGE until someone pointed it out to me. And I was like,
it started as a joke.
Yeah.
That was his, it was with Elon. It's always, like, you know, it's always a joke. It's always a bad joke. It's DOGE. It's a meme coin that everybody would have forgotten about 10 years ago, unless Elon Musk thought it was funny. But they went and, you know, Trump sort of, it's not a government organization. It's going to advise the government.
Not a real department.
it's not a real department.
But it's going to propose killing a bunch of real departments.
That's what it's going to do. And so, you know, so Musk and Ramaswamy have this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today where they outline what they intend to do, which is to eliminate $2 trillion from the government. That would mean the firing of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of government workers. They've put forward the most asinine, you know, means of doing this. Ramaswamy was saying, well, you could just pick every government worker whose name starts with a consonant or, like, every other letter in the alphabet and then just fire them. Boom. These guys, like, they have no understanding of government function, nor do they care to obtain much understanding about government function or the bureaucratic function. It's all kind of a game and chess pieces to be moved around to them right now while, you know, they've got some Twitter followers worked up about it. I do think that, like, they could do some real damage, or they could just kind of run into the first wall. Something else presents itself and off they go. But yeah, no, it's a long way of saying, I think that you're right. Like, I could see this world where Trump and Musk, because the one thing that Trump really respects is celebrity and wealth. Elon Musk is the apex of both of those things. He's maybe the most famous man apart from Trump on the planet, and he's fabulously wealthy. And so he has those two things in his corner. And therefore, there's a degree of sort of unapproachability, or he's beyond reproach in a sense to Trump, I think, you know, just from watching their appearances, and like he's tolerating more, where I don't know, I could be wrong too. Trump does really first and foremost care about his ego, and he could just finally decide that Elon's taking too much of the spotlight, especially if like there's an opportune time to push him out. But if there's not, they both have so much to gain from this symbiosis, and that's a fear that it doesn't unravel. We should be preparing for it to not unravel, and just looking at the next 4 years as though Elon Musk is going to continue to be able to wield this level of power, which is beyond the considerable power he already did.
Yeah, and I think that's spot on, right? I think we should be preparing as if it's not going to fall apart, and hope that it does, but make sure we're ready if it doesn't. And I would say as well, you know, on the Department of Government Efficiency, I'm not making a prediction here. Like, it's possible that it is a meme that just kind of like peters out over time and doesn't achieve very much. But I do think that there's another aspect of this, or another version of this, where it plays out that yes, Musk is like a figurehead, is a popular person who is, you know, pushing some of these ideas. So not just his people, but also like a broader Republican base is kind of buying into these sort of things. But he is not the one who is like day to day kind of like going through the documents and seeing what's happening here.
Oh, you definitely know, not.
Ramaswamy has less going on and would be more open to like doing a more day-to-day thing.
Oh, he would love it.
Exactly.
Love it. Just being on TV, sort of, you know, issuing edicts and whatever.
Exactly. But Musk also has this big coterie of people who he can like pull some of them in and assign them to like do some of this work. So like, just like with the rockets and with the cars, Musk will not actually be doing this stuff. He will be taking credit for stuff that other people are doing. And I think that is where the potential for it to be something that actually is carried through, has an impact, is. And I would just say one more thing on that, is that they're talking a lot about Javier Milei, the prime minister or president of Argentina, as they're talking about this, because apparently he has like cut a lot of regulations and public sector workers, and also like, you know, totally crashed the Argentinian currency and stuff. Like, Argentina is not doing good under him, but he's one of these people who they absolutely love, right? And who they're holding up as like this example that they will sort of emulate with this Department of Government Efficiency. And it's interesting, Javier Milei was on Lex Fridman very recently, which is very odd. Yeah.
Right. Another part of the sort of like that right wing coded, and the Lex Fridman is not like an overt political actor, but yeah, it's become clear just through his guests and what kind of views he shares. And he's always one of the top podcasters. He's part of the network there.
There was a funny set of photos going around because the G20 meeting is happening in Brazil right now. And so the Brazilian president Lula is like taking photos with all of the world leaders. And like with every single one, he's like smiling. You know, the French president, the US president, like all these sort of people. And then there's one photo of him with Javier Milei, and like he's like has the biggest frown you could like ever imagine on him.
Lula's not having it.
Yeah.
Argentina was in actual economic crisis that precipitated his election. It's not anything remotely comparable to here. They just like that political project. They like the concept of it. I guess, again, like the same way that Musk fired whatever it was, you know, 80% of his staff when he bought Twitter and turned it into X. It was just sort of the functionality of the site tanked, the popularity of the site tanked. It was a terrible business for a while. And you can add that to the list of things that you listed off earlier.
I'm not sure Americans can handle the functionality of the US government tanking even further. That would be...
Well, that's the thing. And that's my prediction is for this Doge thing, is that he'll probably do some cosmetic stuff. You know, there's a lot of fear around it. And again, the truth about any Trump presidency is that you never really know how afraid you should be, how seriously you should take him. And I think it's smart to take, you know, them at their words when they say they're going to do these things, if only, you know, for political purposes, if only to prepare. But just the amount of bureaucratic maneuvering that would be necessary and the amount of economic tumult that would result from firing that many people, from laying them off, throwing all these people into poverty, it would be absolutely insane. Both would face intense sort of court challenges and bureaucratic resistance, and therefore it might not be, you know, all that interesting for them to do for very long. But the fact that they want to do it And the ideological position that it represents, I think, is still extremely important. And this is what we're working with now, you know, an apparatus that's going to be hostile to public institutions and favorable, cronyistic, and even and transactional with those companies that kiss the ring.
Yeah. And speaking of transaction, I know that we want to talk a bit about the relationship between Trump and Silicon Valley and defense tech and things like that. But on the point of transactions, one of the things that has really stood out to me in all that has been written about all this stuff over the past week or so is, you know, one of the things I remembered from the first Trump presidency is the ways that people tried to get influence with him and his administration in ways that were kind of underhanded and kind of shady, but like were able to pass because it's the United States and these things, you know.
And that he responds to them, right? He responds, if you stay at the Trump Hotel.
That's exactly it, right? Yeah. So like a bunch of world leaders and foreign leaders would like stay at the Trump Hotel in DC and like run up these huge bills. And, you know, you couldn't say directly that they were giving money to Trump, but like they were giving money to Trump. And I'm sure when they were meeting him, were like, man, Trump, your hotel, it's so nice there. I really love my stay, right?
Mar-a-Lago is an extractive, like you have to pay to go to the club and see Trump.
And so I was like, okay, how is this going to play out in this like new second Trump administration? And so there's this story in the Financial Times where they are speaking to media executives who are like, so advertisers who left Twitter or X are going back now because they want to be in Elon Musk's good books to make sure that when they are trying to do stuff with the government, hopefully Elon is like not mad at them and also saying nice things to Trump.
Exactly.
Like at least you make sure that you're not in the crosshairs of Elon Musk and by extension Donald Trump, but like hopefully it also means that Elon Musk is there, Elon Musk is in the room, Elon Musk is talking to Donald Trump, and hopefully he's like, hey, this company is good, you know, because they're paying for advertising.
And he is there. Like so far, like he has his own like walk-on music when he enters a room in Mar-a-Lago. You know, one of the Trump grandchildren was saying he's got uncle status.
Oh my God. Well, he was in the family picture, so.
There's that story about the Google CEO, Sundar Pichai, calling Trump and you like, and then just like Musk is there, like on the call, and he had no idea that he was going to be on. So he's just like taking calls with the president. And this is, remember, like Trump is to some extent sundowning. His mental health was a very gently interrogated question compared to the treatment that Biden got, because it's, you're starting from such a certain point of derangement that makes it hard to really kind of differentiate, I guess. But he's just, I think that's another thing that happened this go round, is that like Trump, even like liberals and lefties will say like Trump is used to be funny. He was funny. He would like, his tweets were funny. All of that guile or that affability even, or like, or some, is that that's gone, and it's been kind of replaced by this, the dark core that I think more people respond to. And I think that's also kind of enabled Musk to kind of take up some of the space, right? Like he's this kind of like surrogate that millions of people around the world clearly admire, clearly love, has all this power, has all this wealth. It's another reason why I don't know if this relationship will sour all that fast, because he says, okay, fine. Like, I'm fine being on equal footing with this guy who clearly, you know, admires and is willing to further my politics. But yeah, nothing good is going to come of any of this.
Yeah. I hardly even want to imagine a President J.D. Vance at this point. You know, you say Donald Trump is sundowning, and like, you have to imagine at some point, like, he's gone and J.D. Vance, you know, succeeds him. You know, whether that happens during this term, like whether he dies within 4 years, or whether they somehow manage to like run J.D. Vance as a presidential candidate in 4 years and he wins, which again, I think is like something that is probably not going to happen. But oh man, it would be even worse than Trump in my view.
Yeah, I don't know though, because I think like the permission structure around J.D. Vance is different. If Trump's gone, then it's going to leave a big sort of vacuum, a big void, and J.D. Vance will be one of many players trying to vie for power, including perhaps Elon Musk.
That is a good point, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Trump is quite singular in a lot of ways. I mean, everything that he stands for has been built up and enabled by decades of Republican politics and neoliberal economics. But his ability to sort of command such adulation and his charisma is pretty unique. I think, you know, J.D. Vance might inherit power at some point, but whether or not he's able to wield it is another question altogether.
I find him more like ideological, right? And that's why I feel like he's potentially more, more willing to try to push some of these things forward.
If he could execute them.
Yeah, I think the point that you say about Trump having like the leniency to actually push these things in a way that other people wouldn't, I think that is actually really spot on. Like, I don't think Vance would so easily get away with appointing a bunch of whack jobs to cabinet, but it's like, it's Trump. This is what he does. He has the support of all these people. Like, it'll happen.
Yeah. People are afraid to question him or to push back in a way. And that, I think, and you teased it earlier, but another thing that we're going to see quite a lot of, and that we're already starting to see, is this sort of boom in defense tech companies coming to the White House and getting already sort of signals from Elon and Trump that they're going to be more prominent and play a larger role, just like Bitcoin boomed to its highest price ever into the 90,000s after Trump was elected, because he has his own like grifty coin now that, you know, he's all in on crypto. I haven't seen a story yet that's like how much Trump world has profited directly from their stupid, you know, Trump coin or the Trump NFTs since the boom of it all went up.
Is Trump coin going to become like one of the currencies of the United States?
I'm telling you, that's a story though, because I feel like it's all up. Like Bitcoin is up insane. It looked like it was headed towards 100K for a second. And this is a currency that has just, you know, crashed multiple times, wiped out whole savings. But just like that's happening, I feel like a lesser told story has been the boom in like defense tech stocks. Like Palantir, for a while, its market cap boomed past Lockheed Martin, one of historically the largest defense contractors. You know, it's up there with Boeing in the United States.
It is so wild how the valuations of these quote unquote tech companies can be so out of sync with like traditional companies that do so much more. Like, it's just another example of that. I think Tesla is like worth more than almost all the other car companies combined, or maybe even more than all of them combined now. Like, it's wild.
But that's been true for a while. I mean, yeah. Tesla has always been this mystery for that reason. It's all narrative. And that's why Elon Musk tells so many bold-faced lies about the future, about going to Mars, about self-driving cars, about fully self-driving cars, about robo-taxis, about robot butlers. It's all, you're buying into this story. And the insane and frustrating thing so far is that he has been borne out so far. Now he's sitting next to the president of the United States. If you invest in his companies, like, now you have invested in this guy who has more power than anyone except Trump himself. It is truly a deeply insane moment, even though half of his companies, if not more, have by any traditional metrics failed. X is a failure. Who knows what's going on with his AI company that's all in the startup phase, but just basically lives on X and is like a D-list open AI. We could tick them all off, but that's another element here where Elon Musk stands to directly benefit just government contracts and all this stuff. Here we go. Police departments with Cybertrucks, ICE departments with Cybertrucks, Teslas for government agencies. I don't know.
At least their vehicles, you know, the ICE vehicles and stuff, the Cybertrucks will break down. And you know, that's one upside, maybe. Run into a ton of problems.
So it really is a great moment of swirling uncertainty and madness. And something like this, a situation like this, is what so many people were worried about. Silicon Valley sort of just ascending to this level of power. It's, you know, when I say Silicon Valley, I don't mean all of like the rank and file tech workers who are now kind of just worried about their jobs, worried about if they, you know, protest, will they get fired? There's this new climate in Silicon Valley that's much more buttoned up, much more sort of authoritarian leaning. But, you know, we have the same collection of tech monopolies that are, you know, more powerful, more wealthy than ever. Another tech monopolist or an aspiring one, you know, right at the White House. And this nexus and this conjoining of power in a way that at least presents in a new way. We've been talking about defense tech, and Sam Biddle at The Intercept has a great piece about how the warrior class of tech titan like Peter Thiel, these types, are among the most to benefit in Trump world. And, you know, he points out that there's always been this symbiotic relationship between Silicon Valley and the state. But now it's brazen. The politics have changed, right? Facebook, Apple, Google, these startups, and Do Real, like, they don't feel like they have to stay in the shadows. Mark Zuckerberg can call Trump a badass. It's just an all on board moment. And, you know, they're not afraid of just saying, Yep, we have more money than God, and now as we're going to appease one guy, and we don't care if we appease our users or certainly the public.
Yeah, I still have this image in my head of a Cybertruck like around the border in like the south of Texas, like going off road chasing undocumented immigrants and like getting stuck on some like dune or something like that. But you know, I think what you're saying is totally spot on. And I feel like when we're talking about this relationship to the defense tech industry, I feel like it's important to say that those connections have started to be cemented under the Biden administration, in large part because of, you know, this growing hostility or division between the US and China, and how much the tech industry has been able to take advantage of that to make sure that they are saying, look, not just do you need us to like compete in this new geopolitical game that you're embarking on, but to make sure that the Chinese aren't getting ahead of us in, you know, military capabilities, we need the Pentagon to be buying a lot more of, you know, this stuff from these new defense startups, not just from like the old Lockheed Martins and things like that. And so that's why you're seeing Palantir rise, you're seeing Anduril rise, and a bunch of other companies that are getting started whose whole goal is to say, we are making AI solutions for war, or we are making new weapons technologies that, you know, take advantage of AI piloting or targeting or whatever. And we often talk about this kind of stuff as though like Israel is doing it or China is doing it or something like that. But like tons of American companies are getting in on this, and the Pentagon is increasingly turning its fire hose of money to those companies to make sure that they can rise, to make sure they're getting a ton of public contracts. We talk a lot about Elon Musk and like the money SpaceX and stuff gets, but like there's a ton of these companies that are getting a lot of public money.
Yeah, OpenAI has a defense contract now. Any of those platitudes, you know, around doing no evil or sort of public-facing goodwill, or that's gone, I feel like. And this election has quite potently sort of wiped them clean, and it's been clarifying both for us, the public, and for the companies themselves that we don't need to do this shit anymore. We don't need those slogans. We don't need to say that we're going to form oversight committees. We're just going to do. And that's the world that we're going to be living in for the next 4 years at least. Silver lining, I think, maybe a little utopian. But if we can, you know, pull ourselves out of this wreckage after 4 years, I think it will at least be a more interesting environment to sort of go after the tech companies afterwards. I think the Democrats, like you were saying, like it wasn't just Biden, it was Obama before him. It was decades worth of sort of this relationship between Silicon Valley and the state, and Obama being a big booster of Airbnb and Uber and being very friendly. And
SpaceX too, yeah.
SpaceX, yeah. Tesla, it's big, yeah. Not, you know, sort of vowing not to regulate, you know, presenting them as though they were progressive companies doing good. And they kind of coasted on that reputational aura for a long time. And I think that too has been wiped clean. I don't think it's going to, you know, go away willingly, but people are going to have to be reminded that all these companies just lined up behind Trump. But we can just say now, and we can see them for what they are. They're these big extractive firms that have a monopoly over search and are just intensely uninterested in, you know, the quality of the user experience at the expense of taking as much information and data and ad dollars as they can from you. Laying that bare might have its utility in the future because, you know, there are still some really, I think, awful parties and to the Democratic project who are saying like, oh, we should have been nicer to Elon Musk. It's our, we drove him away. It struck me as like really grotesque. I forget who was on that panel. I know Kara Swisher was. There was this like CNN roundtable. It might have even been like Ro Khanna, who is good on some other things. And they're like, you know, we really should have invited Elon to the White House more and not been so hard on him with. But it's like, no, that's not it.
Ro Khanna's good on some things, but like because he's the Silicon Valley guy, like he's really bad on other things.
All right. Well, that's true of a lot of California politics. Yeah. You'll see right on up to our, to the governor.
Right on up to Kamala Harris, too, and her buddy with
Via Tony West, yeah, exactly. The chief legal counsel of Uber, who was her major campaign advisor and who told her to go easy on big business and to sort of blunt some of those attacks so that they could win over corporations rather than sort of talking about what people were actually feeling, which is being gouged by them and higher prices and the fact that they can't pay rent. And instead, it sort of seems like his voice really was one of the major contributors to this sort of very tepid campaign that, you know, as we know now, you know, failed pretty dramatically.
Now all the corporations are thrilled because they have Donald Trump and they're going to benefit immensely. You know, when you were saying there's a silver lining here, I thought you were going to say the left can seize all these new AI military technologies and build fully automated militarized communism to bring on the utopia. But apparently that's not it. You know, very grim, right?
You went in the accelerationist stance. Yeah. No, I will never be an accelerationist.
Yeah. But, you know, I think this has been like a good conversation to dig into what is going on with Trump. But I know to end off these episodes, what we're going to try to do is also go through some of the kind of big topics of the week, some of the bigger stories that have been on our radars that we want to go into. And I know that you in particular have been focused on one that has been looking on how AI is being used with screenplays in particular. What's going on there?
Yeah, there was a great piece in The Atlantic this week by Alex Reeser, who's done a number of these sort of data-driven deep dives into what is in some of these databases that are being used to train AI. And, you know, few of these reports are surprising or revelatory in the sense that, oh, wow, like these books were used to train. Because, I mean, most people are operating under the assumption that if it's available on the internet in any form, then these companies have found a way to ingest it into their systems.
Yeah, they've stolen it. Yeah.
They've stolen it. It's useful to know and to be able to point to the details. And so I think he's really doing God's work here. And so he determined that one of the databases that has been used to train some of the top systems, like Meta's Llama, Apple's system, it showed up in Anthropic, it looks like. But it's 50,000 film screenplays and 85,000 teleplays turned up in these databases he was able to identify. And so the AI models were trained on all of this dialogue from films and from TV shows. And of course, the companies didn't seek any permission or to license this material or to pay the creators. It's the same story over and over again. And when I shouted this out on Twitter, you know, Osita Nonevu, the great writer and Guardian columnist, made the point. It's just like, it is stunning that even after all of these revelations, this keeps happening. Revelations keep happening like this. There has been no ramifications whatsoever for the companies. There's been no attempt to hold them accountable by government, right? There have been class action lawsuits. It's fallen to the creators, the artists, the writers, the authors to sort of band together and try to fight on behalf of all other writers and artists and creators to try to claw back some of what was essentially stolen and is being used again around the world in for-profit software. There's maybe a moment, you know, years ago where they would lean on this sort of altruistic sort of framing where, you know, like, oh, we're building AGI, it's for the good of everybody. We know what they're doing with it now. Now it is just bluntly obvious. You're building enterprise software to sell to consulting firms, to sell to marketing companies, to sell to Fortune 500 companies, to try to automate the production of text. That is what you guys are doing with it, and sometimes images. That is the chief aim of this project. And the fact that we have, and again, under Trump now, it's really hard to imagine anything beyond these more local fights. Certainly, there's going to be no meaningful regulation put in place to protect creators' rights, certainly not on a federal level. Even the sort of scant, you know, Schumer and Biden AI stuff is going to be out the door. I still think we need to be outraged about it. I still think we have to try to organize about it. The artistic community is really pretty incredible on this stuff, and they are pushing back in ways that are forceful and very public. And yeah, so it really is a travesty. Every detail we learn, the picture just gets a little bit worse.
Yeah, just on that point about, like, you know, the pushback to it and how these companies are trying to automate text, there have also been stories more coming out recently about publishers also trying to sell their books to AI companies, you know, to get some money for licensing them for, you know, AI training and things like that. And
yeah, HarperCollins was the big one this week. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, just before we were recording this earlier in the day, I got an email from the Writers Union of Canada, which I'm a part of, where they were expressing their cautious optimism about the AI licensing market and how much authors might be able to make from it. And the first thing that came to my mind was this speech that Ursula K. Le Guin gave in 2014, where she said that we should never let, quote, literature get sold down the river. And I feel like that is exactly what they are doing in being open to taking this money for AI training, because they are completely gutting this profession and just to make a few bucks in the short term. And I just think it's so gross.
On the one hand, I empathize, right? Like the media world, especially the text-based media world, journalism, magazines, newspapers, they're all just, thanks in large part to conditions brought about by major tech companies like Meta and Google and sort of their clawing away of ad revenue from publishers over the years, and Craigslist and eBay before that, they are desperate, right? The publishers are desperate for anything. And compared to sort of past deals, maybe this one doesn't look as bad. I think, you know, what we've already sort of turned everything else over. You know, we've let our content sort of live on these platforms, be shared on these platforms. They just want to use it to train, and we can at least make a few bucks in the process. There's always going to be a need for original reporting, original writing. That's kind of tends to be how it goes. But once again, sort of the outcome of this election to me kind of calls that sort of thinking very much into question. You know, Matt Pearce, a former colleague of mine at the Times, has been doing really great work writing about sort of the economics of digital media and sort of media infrastructure. He tried to lead the charge to get, you know, Google to pay its fair share in the ad dollars that it's taken from journalism earlier this year in an effort that wound up failing. Look at all these themes coming together. Crushed by Gavin Newsom, who threatened to veto because he's so close to Silicon Valley.
Hey, well, that's down there in the United States. Up here in Canada, we got $100 million from Google.
That's right. I know people have problems with it. It's not perfect, but it's better. It's something. It's at least a means of clawing back a little bit of that value that Google and Facebook have taken away. And here, now we have this ecosystem where we have been shown that maybe people don't really care that much about original reporting and journalism. That's been one of the storylines in the election postmortems, is that the New York Times endorsements and the August magazines and newspapers didn't really matter as much as the Joe Rogans and the stuff that's cheaper and easier to make, the stuff that is friendly to the tech platforms, the stuff that you can upload a bunch of stuff. It doesn't really matter if it's fact-checked or true or not. In it goes to the ecosystem, which is in many ways like sort of this bloggy, soundbitey, you know, cheap and easy, ready-made content factories are really just sort of paving the way for AI. And so maybe I think it's kind of foolish to think that we won't be competing with a lot of this AI content. So just letting them have all the materials at relatively low prices, just letting them have this data and the rights to use it, we're basically, you know, sort of giving them access to materials to make stuff that they can churn out now for cheap that we're then going to be competing with in the media. I do think that I get it. Again, you want a little buck. You want to stay afloat. You also don't want to look like you're behind the times. What is AI? Maybe it's cool. But we've seen this story play out so many times. We've seen what happens when you cede ground to Silicon Valley. We've pivoted to video before. I just think we're going to regret it. I think most major media companies that sort of hand this work over are going to find all kinds of unforeseeable, quote, you know, problems with the arrangements a few years down the line. And I think that we should be resisting this stuff if we really care about human-generated art or human-generated work or writing.
I would say I think it's a whole discussion that we can maybe have on a different episode, but I feel like this narrative that podcasters are so influential now is maybe a bit overblown to kind of take some of the blame away from the Democratic Party just not running a great...
Well, that until ours gets out there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is going to be the next big influential podcast. But, you know, you were talking about platforms. And the other story that we wanted to get to round this episode off is, of course, the takeoff of Blue Sky, you know, which has now surpassed 20 million users and seems to just have these usual kind of tech adoption charts that you kind of see, where you see like this kind of shoot up of adoption. It feels like Blue Sky is on this trajectory now where the number of daily users it's adding just keeps like kind of exponentially growing as there's this growing exodus away from Twitter X in particular. And I'm sure some of the other platforms as people kind of come over there as well. I've really been enjoying Blue Sky. You know, to me, it just feels fun again. Like I like engaging with people on there. I think it has some fun features that bring people in, you know, starter packs in particular, like allowing people to follow, you know, people who you think are interesting in different, you know, kind of types of on different subject matters or what, however you want to put it together, you know, like whatever theme you want to make a pack on is cool. You can have these feeds that, you know, can be put together in many different ways. So you don't just have this algorithmic feed that like Facebook or Twitter is throwing at you with its kind of hidden algorithm there. It feels different. And it feels like the people who are making it are responsive to the user base and kind of the expectations that they have. And so obviously we know, we have seen the story with social media platforms. It looks great in the beginning and then things turn. Of course, Blue Sky doesn't have a monetization plan yet. But after seeing everything that has happened with Twitter and X recently, I'm trying to be a bit hopeful that maybe Blue Sky will be like our new digital home to have some fun. But we'll see.
Well, we wanted to end the show on like on a hopeful note here. And I think the fact that Blue Sky is so popular, it has gained 20 million active users so quickly. I argued in my newsletter this week that it really shows that there is a hunger for this, and that Blue Sky is so popular in large part because it's giving users what big tech has taken away or is taking away. Everything you're talking about, customization, user control, ways to block and to sort of shape your online experience. Things that if a company that is trying to sell you a product doesn't hate you, things that it might want to give you so you will spend more time there, other than the fact that you're just locked in and you have to be there because everybody else is there. And now there's going to be paid tiers where you can get boosted in replies. And now we're going to harvest your data for our AI system. Blue Sky doesn't do any of that. It's just very user-focused, very user-forward. It has its problems, like you said. It has taken VC money from Blockchain Capital, which is just right on its head, an ominous-sounding name to a lot of tech watchers.
I loved in the post where they explained that they took this money, where they were like, don't worry, we're not going to be implementing crypto stuff or NFTs. Like,
yeah, we're like, okay. Okay, good. I mean, I don't know if I totally believe you, but
exactly,
okay.
Yeah. No,
yeah, but it's a small team. They're mixing it up. They're talking to people. They're listening. When I've shared the story that I wrote, one of the lead devs interacted with the post. And so they're taking notes, and it just feels very different. And it's a reminder to me, I think, in what's otherwise a very bleak moment, that like these spaces and these structures are possible. And by looking at, you know, what is possible and what can feel good and what can facilitate some actually, you know, funny or meaningful interactions online rather than just sort of hostile ones, I think it's a reminder that it is worth, you know, pushing on. It is worth fighting for these things. There are alternatives that are possible. To get that widely, you may need to peel apart big tech. You may need to break up these monopolies. You may need to actually hold Facebook accountable for some of the things that it's done. But it shows that there is another way. And it has just been fun to be on there, to commiserate. You should come on there if you're not already. The knock it gets is that it's all homogenous. And I'd say that's only a little bit true.
I love my echo chamber.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of good folks on there.
Listen, I get replies from crypto people that I block right away. You know, there's still people I don't like on there.
There you go. Plenty of intellectual diversity, us and crypto people.
Yeah. So. Well, Brian, I think that is episode one in the bag. How are you feeling as a podcaster with one episode done.
I feel like I've wielded my podcasting kit quite gracefully. I don't know. What do you think?
The Best Buy cashier will be very proud of you right now.
I'll go back and tell him how it went. I'll have like a little QR code. You can download the podcast.
I love that. Well, this has been System Crash, Episode 1. System Crash is hosted by Paris Marks and Brian Merchant. Production is by Eric Wickham. Our theme music is Dystopia by our good friends in Yacht. Support the show at patreon.com/systemcrashpod to get a monthly bonus episode.
Yeah, that's right. And stay tuned. In the future, we'll have all kinds of interesting things to dive into. We'll do interviews and some reading series from our Silicon Valley overlords and all kinds of interesting commentary and journalism. I can't wait to keep this thing rolling with you, Paris.
Me too. More to come, but for now, goodbye.